President Trump from the Oval Office this afternoon said, don't worry about the Iran war. We've got this. We'll just keep on hitting them until they eventually bend to our will. And if we need to, we'll just go and finish the job. And that will get the Strait of Hormuz open. So everything is going really well. So don't even worry. Oh, wait a minute. There's that issue of reality. Yeah, we need to look at this because there's some other players here who have a little different opinion about how things are actually going and what it's going to take to get this war solved. And we are delighted to have back with us today Suleiman Ahmed, who was just back from Iran, has had some amazing interviews with some of the senior leaders over there and has a lot of contacts both with Ansar Allah, the Houthis, about what's going on with the Bab al-Mandab. All kinds of stuff, and really looking forward to picking your brain here. Welcome back to the show, Suleiman.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate you having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, man, me too, especially. Listen, I want to start off just before you left Iran. Last time we had you on, you were still in Iran. And then subsequent to that, you had an interview with Ismail Baghaei, the foreign ministry spokesman, who is often the face of the Iranian regime itself and, you know, the one who's putting forth their official positions on things. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what your view was on what your impressions were of that interview, and what did he say that may have surprised you?
Yeah, he's a very intellectual man, very smart man. Initially, when they asked me to go, it meant to be a 15-minute off-the-record conversation. They called it a backroom conversation. And I asked them, can I interview? And they said, look, it's going to be highly unlikely. So I said, okay, no problem. So I went and went to meet first of all, people within the foreign ministry, very brilliant people, very respectful. We had long conversations with them. I think I spent like an hour with them talking to a number of high-level personnel within the foreign ministry, and then had the privilege to talk to Ismail Baghaei. And I think we both enjoyed the conversation because we ended up speaking for a good couple of hours. We spoke about many issues. We talked about the war, obviously. We talked about geopolitics. We talked about some of the concerns I had myself about, or some of the questions I personally had, which I thought I had questions about Iran's decision-making. And similarly, we talked about philosophy, history, AI, and various other things. And I think he enjoyed the conversation because then I said, it'd be lovely to have this conversation, you know, on the air. And then he said, okay, let's do it. So we did it. And initially they said 15 minutes. He said, don't worry, just do it however long you want. But I tried to be respectful to the situation. So it was really good. Very lot of information. And like, as an example, one of the questions I asked him, I said, look, one of the issues I have is Trump cares about the financial market. And what's happening is every Friday he says he's going to war, and every Sunday he says there's peace. And my issue is that I feel like Iran's too slow in the response, and you're allowing him to manipulate the market. Mm. And my own belief is that he cares more about the market, he cares more about his own personal finances than he does the war. And if that's not going well for him, maybe he'll be less active or less persistent about continuing the kinetic part of the war. So I said that to them, and they said that, look, what it is the issue we have is we want to be as accurate as possible. And for us, it matters to be truthful. I know Trump doesn't really care about that. And so what that means is when we are basically writing a response, we take it and put it through a few different people, a few different departments to make sure it's accurate so that what we're saying is legitimate. So that was kind of his response. So that's just an insight into the kind of conversation we had off the air. But I did learn quite a lot of things from him, as well as I learned a number of things from the officials in the foreign ministry, which I'm looking forward to talking to about.
And what were some of the things that maybe not surprised you the most, but that you found was the most meaningful that if people understand, it can give us a better understanding of where the Iranian thinking is and where this war could go?
Yeah, I mean, his psychology was this. It was kind of like, it's not a contradiction, but it kind of shows the overlapping nature of it. So his position was this, that they want to negotiate. Like, their position is always to negotiate. They want peace. The number one thing is peace. But then he said, we're always willing to defend ourselves. And he always talked about how even their military actions are from a defensive perspective as opposed to an offensive perspective. And so he said, look, we always want to deal. We always want to negotiate, but we're willing to defend ourselves from a military perspective. But that being said, in terms of from the military perspective, we have put a large number of things in place in order to defend ourselves. And so we talked about some of those issues, and not just with him. I talked about other key members of Iran, not just the foreign ministry, but other aspects, which I don't want to say because I don't want to get in trouble. But I talked about a number of people, and I kind of have an overarching idea about what the plan is. And I think the plan is this. They're not going to strike, as an example, Israel first, but they are expecting Israel to strike at some point. And I think what's happened is because Israel's become aware of Iran's strategy, now you've seen, for example, a lot of statements coming out today. There was a statement from Smotrich saying that they don't want to join the war. They like it as it is now. And the reason for that is because if you remember, I came to your show, I believe it was on your show, when I said Iran's in 7 to 10 days, they're going to, you know, they're going to plan something big. Something big
yes.
is coming.
Yes, and I remember
now,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So it was on your show. And so now we're about 3 to 5 days away from that. And they are planning something huge, which is going to be quite devastating. They're going to be using a lot more missiles that they've never used before. And the mode and method that they're going to use has never been used before. And what I mean by that is if you look up to the lead up to these 7 to 10 days, what's happened is Iran has systematically taken out, essentially, if you look at it, Israel's defense. There's other aspects to it as well we'll talk about. Oh, yeah, brilliant. You've got it on there. So they've taken out Israel's defense. And so if you look at, for example, Jordan was basically the early radar systems in Jordan, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, the air defense systems, the aviation facilities and hangars, the logistical hubs, the fuel and ammunition storage, CENTCOM infrastructure, all of these things. What the way Iran viewed it was there was two methods for it. One, and actually three, the other one is the ground invasion part, which we'll talk about later. But there's two methods with it. One is the military bases within those regions, but the other one is the defense of Israel. And so if you remember, in the first element of the war, the Ramadan war, they took out the Al Udeid airbase, the radar system in there, which was it was worth $1 billion. And that radar system was warning Israel. It was giving it like a 15-minute warning. And once that radar system was taken out, the warning time was reduced significantly. And now what they've done is with this mechanism, taking out Muwafiq Salty airbase, striking it significantly, as well as Bahrain and Kuwait, you basically have it where there's less warning for these missiles. Then you've got the issue with the defense interceptors. And then if Jordan's not able to defend them, you're basically going to have open season on Israel. And so Israel's kind of seen these moves being made. And obviously, they're not stupid. They realize that this is a tactical mode that has been implemented by Iran, which has been escalatory over this time. And they're expecting something huge within 3 to 5 days. The thing with Iran is, which obviously some of us may not agree with this, but the thing is, we don't want to strike Israel until they strike us. And so Israel's in this quagmire where they want to be part of the war because, you know, Trump is kind of struggling to get too deep into the war in terms of if you look at the attacks that are occurring. But at the same time, they're so afraid of the consequences that you're basically in this quagmire. So Israel's kind of in this situation. Will they respond or not? But if they do, there's going to be a significant response against them and that response will be ready in 3 to 5 days.
Dan, you got to bring yourself back in.
I'm so sorry about that. Do you have any sense for what that's going to be? What is going to be the target? I mean, we just had this up here a second ago talking about the things that they have been hitting here of late. But what is that to set up? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so that's that element. And then there's a second important element. People in Iran, and I've talked to a number of people, and, you know, we may disagree with this, but I don't. I think they obviously know better. They've got the intel. They believe that there's highly likely going to be an attempt at a, I know this is going to annoy you, Daniel, but there is going to be a chance of a ground incursion. And so into one of the islands in close to them, likely Karg Island. And so obviously they have traps within Karg Island if that decision was made. But more than that, they said to me that they're seeing accumulation of forces in Kuwait. This is why they're striking Kuwait. Also, in terms of the Kurds, they do believe that the Kurds are still going to try and go in. They don't believe the story that, you know, oh, we got the weapons and we stole the weapons of the, you know, when Trump said, oh, we gave the weapons to the Kurds and they kind of took them. They don't believe that story. They believe that that's just, you know, subterfuge. And in reality, they are going to attempt to go in. And so this is why you've seen the consistent attacks on Erbil, on Sulaymaniyah, in order to weaken any opportunity for Kurdish forces to try and go in. So there is this notion of belief that that's happening. So this is why they're striking Kuwait so significantly. This is why you're seeing almost consistent, persistent attacks on Kurdish areas in Iraq. And then separate to that, they are weakening American forces. First of all, removing them far away from Iran as possible. The reason, again, is because they're aware, they're fully aware of the crisis that the U.S. has in terms of oil, petroleum, and fuel. And so they want to try and move them across. They literally have, there's someone in Ghalibaf's department whose sole job is to basically keep track live the oil reserves in the United States of America. And so you basically have it where they're trying to push the U.S. out more because, again, you're further out you are, the more fuel you're going to use. And so there's kind of like a multi-pronged attack that's going on, which, and then you can see the fruits of that by the attacks that are occurring.
And what is the objective of these ramping this up? Would it be to cause the United States to come back to the table? Because there's one thing, actually, before we get too far away from your conversation with Ismail Baghaei, is I think it was yesterday I saw, if I'm not mistaken, Abbas Araghchi, who said he still felt that there was like a 10% chance that there could be a negotiated settlement, which really surprised me because I'm thinking with what we did in 2025, what we did to start this war, what we did with the MOU came out. I mean, we never keep our word on anything. I don't know why they would want to abide by anything. I mean, it's not just the Strait of Hormuz, but it's also the frozen assets. It's sanctions on the energy, the $300 billion. I mean, they're not talking about any of this stuff. Iran literally got nothing out of this except for a temporary opening of the Strait of Hormuz where they got some of their oil out. But so why would they trust us for anything at all and even contemplate this alleged 10-day ceasefire that some are talking about? Or do you think that's actually realistic at all?
Yeah, I mean, look, they said to me they don't trust the United States of America. They do not believe that they basically will commit to any deal that they make. That being said, they said that, look, we need to be pragmatic. You can't have a scenario where you're not willing to negotiate with the enemy because that just means you're going to have perpetual war. So there's going to be a scenario throughout this entire period of time where there will be negotiations. Now, as you said, there is this kind of thought, and that's why he said 10%, that it's highly unlikely those deals will ever come about because the U.S. is incapable of fulfilling any deal. But that being said, the psychology is that they want the deal. Their psychology is that they've got responsibility for the Iranian people and they don't want Iran to be under perpetual war. So there is this, no doubt, Abbas Araghchi, what he's saying is the feeling within the foreign ministry. He is the head of the foreign ministry and the government, which is that they are willing to make a deal. It's just that they don't believe the U.S. will. And the way they see it is this, because I discussed it with them. I said, look, I do think that, you know, if you look at the entirety of the war, okay, there's one thing. But if you look at each part, and they agreed with me on this when we were having this conversation, that if you look at each part of the war as a separate stage, then from Iran's perspective, they believe that they've won each element of the stage. And you got to look at each stage as its unique element. And so what I mean by that is if you look at the first stage, the first 39 days, they told me that Trump basically within week two was asking for a deal, was asking for a ceasefire, and they continued it going. And even till the end, there was disagreement between Ghalibaf and Pezeshkian. Pezeshkian wanted the deal, as in he said, look, let's just make the deal. And Ghalibaf wanted to delay it by another week. And they came to like something in the middle, hence why the deal happened when it happened. But when they look at the first 39 days, they say, look, we won the kinetic power, we weakened the United States of America, we weakened their bases and the defense interceptors. Then you look at the next element. The next element was where it was essentially Iranian vessels coming out and not much American vessels coming out. So they've seen themselves as, again, winning that element of the economic aspect. Then you had the blockade. Now, the blockade was more of a wash, as in they feel like they shaded it a bit. They got some vessels out, but it wasn't as successful as the other parts, but it wasn't as successful as the United States of America. So they see that as a slight victory, maybe like a wash. And then the MOU, the way they see it is the U.S. obviously did not fulfill anything in the deal except one thing, which was they allowed the oil to be unsanctioned, which meant Iran was able to sell about 70 million barrels. They made something between $7 to $10 billion, and the U.S. never got anything. So in that element, they see it as like a victory, as in they managed to get that income in. Some of that money is going to be used for the military. Some of the money is going to be used for the people, and that's just going to help them as the war continues. And now they see it as this current part of the kinetic war, you're seeing where Trump, the way they see Trump's attacks is, he just continued to attack the South. And this is their position, which is he continues to attack the South. He continues to attack the same regions continuously. Sometimes he's attacking the same spots over and over and over again. Whereas what you're seeing with Iran is a systemized approach where they're taking out the bases, they're weakening the bases, they're removing the radar systems, they're removing the ability to defend those areas as well as the areas as well as Israel. And so the way they're seeing it is, once again, they're succeeding in this element. And this is what I've been told. I've been told that, once again, Trump is actually desperate for a deal. And the 10 days you're referring to is actually Trump has been on the call with Field Marshal Assam Mania almost every day, but very consistently. When I say Trump, I mean the Trump administration, begging to get back to negotiations. Iran's stance is, and this is what I've been told, and again, it doesn't mean that this will be the final conclusion, but their stance is that the MOU now is suspended. If you want to go back to the table, there's going to have to be more concessions made, because once again, you attacked our country and broke the MOU and went against Article 5 and Article 1, but specifically Article 5 in this occasion. And so you can't be trusted. They told me, actually, this is what Ismail Baghai told me. He said, look, we were fulfilling the MOU. The MOU said, Article 5, the arrangements need to be done by Iran. And he told me this before. I can't remember if he said it in the interview, but he said the arrangements need to be done by Iran. We had 30 days. In those 30 days, I said, we need to negotiate with Oman. We need to negotiate with the other Gulf states. He said, we were doing that. We were negotiating with everybody. We were bringing everybody on board for as part of the conversation. We were developing the conversation. And we were speaking about to Oman, as per the MOU, that after the 30 days, there would be a joint administration of the Strait of Hormuz. But then the Americans end up trying to create this new corridor. And this new corridor, what they're seeing it as, is a affront on the Article 5. But also, they believed that there is some kind of, you know, from a military perspective, from a security perspective, there was a major issue as well in terms of the Americans having access to that as well. So this is the reason why they had to
stop. Yeah, and that came on the I remember, because I've shown that headline here a couple of days ago. That came on the 24th of June, 7 days after the signing of the MOU. So we immediately tried to set up this southern corridor on Oman, so we can imagine. And let me ask if you have any insider knowledge about what was going on in Oman that got them, because they were working kind of with Iran, and that's why it was in the MOU in paragraph 5. But now all of a sudden, apparently, the United States put a lot of pressure on Oman to get them to agree to open this corridor. Do you have any insight into that?
It's exactly what you said. This is what I was told. I was told that with Oman, Iran doesn't have any problems with Oman. They were negotiating with Oman, but Oman, not being a very strong nation, has been bullied by the United States of America. And because they've been bullied by the United States of America, they've basically put themselves in a situation where they are not abiding by the MOU and they are not basically standing up to the United States of America. And they're just like a weak nation in the sense of they're being bullied into the current situation.
And but I mean, if the United States, and this would seem to even still undercut the diplomatic path and the diplomatic folks in the Iran who wants to get back to that. Because if we, with 7 days in, went and gummed up the works here on what was our own interest, it was our interest to get that thing open as soon as possible to get the flow of oil going back into the global market for everybody's price to come down. And yet we interjected in there almost as though, and I don't know if you've heard anything on this or not, but I a number of things make me look around and think, it almost looks like we wanted this thing to fail because we wanted to go back to conflict by introducing that on the 7th day, not even the 30 days, just 7 days in. And of course, then that started all this tit for tat, especially from the 7th of July forward, where we're now, it's 11 straight days of attacks. Is there any concern on the Iranian side that really, why even bother with this? Because if that didn't work after 7 days, why would something on the 10 days work later on? And that actually leads into the second question that I have for you regarding that. What do you understand about the battle inside of Iran, those who do want this negotiation and those who are saying, I told you we shouldn't have had a negotiation first, but I don't know if it's Ghalibaf or the IRGC that's saying we're in the position of military superiority right now. We have the leverage with the Strait and now possibly with Bab al-Mandab. So we don't have to give in to anything. Let's just sit back and wait until the pain gets bad enough on America. Is that a consideration for some in Iran?
Yeah, two great questions. So the first one is the way they see what the Americans were attempting to do was, the first thing the Americans were attempting to do was to try and But what they were trying to do, what they believe the Americans are trying to do, is not even break the MOU, which they were trying to do. They were trying to break the MOU. But separate to that, or in addition to that, there was this kind of testing to see how far they would go, or how far they could go. And so they were trying to take control of the strait and to see if Iran would let them. And the issue they had is because Iran was so strong in the and resolute in the fact that they had to have control of the Strait of Hormuz, Trump was then basically pressured into acting. So that's what the way they see it, in addition to obviously the Americans breaking it and not being consistent with the deal. In terms of the second question that you asked, which is, so what was the second question again?
It was about, is there a group with this IRGC, whoever this is, don't have a deal now at all, just let the pressure build up until they give us what we want?
Yeah, look, in Iran, I don't see it the way, and I haven't been there and spoke to all the different parties, all the different political persuasions. It's not that there is this kind of disagreement. There is the, obviously you have Ghalibaf, Araghchi, and Pezeshkian, who are essentially the negotiators. Now, the will of the people is totally different to what the government wants. This is obviously quite clear. The government, as I mentioned, are always willing to negotiate. The people do not want negotiations. When you go into Iran, when you went to the funeral, people were persistent and consistent that they wanted a response. They wanted revenge. They wanted justice. The red flags were everywhere. The red flags of revenge. There was more red flags than there were flags of the country of Iran. They want revenge. Similar to not just the three funeral processions I went to, but even there is the Revolutionary Square, and you have tens of thousands of people in one of the days, hundreds of thousands of people with the red flags. They want that. And so if you remember the statement by Mujtaba Khamenei where he said, we want revenge, this wasn't Mujtaba Khamenei, the supreme leader. This was him just relaying what the people are saying. And such was the level of passion of the people that they do not want a deal with the United States of America. This has obviously pressured the negotiators because they're not able to make a deal or make any concessions when you have that type of scenario. Not that they wanted any concessions, but even talking to America was something that was considered off limits. In addition to that, when you go to Iran, what you find is that the Americans and the Israelis struck civilian areas intentionally. And it's quite clear that it was intentional because there's a number of those areas, and I did a report on this, they're not military bases. There's no military bases close by. Some of them are civilian apartments, civilian buildings. There was a Jewish synagogue and it had Jewish apartments all around, which what I mean by that, it was Jewish people living in those apartments. And when I spoke to those people, they believed that that strike was intentional by Israel because they were angry with them because they believed that they were Iranian. They were against Israel. They were against Zionism. And so they believe that they were punished. In addition to that, if you look at the other locations that we hit, people believe, for example, the fertility clinic. Once again, people believe that that was intentional. The attack on the journalistic News 2 studio, they believe that that was intentional. Azadi Square. So all of these, they believe that they were intentional. And therefore, because there was no military bases close by. And so what you've got is a population who definitely doesn't want a deal. Now, in terms of the leadership, what the leadership is trying to do is they're trying to balance the will of the people with this notion that, you know, you need to negotiate with the enemy to try and come to some kind of resolution. You can't have a perpetual war. But that being said, when I'm explaining all of that, and I don't think there's a disagreement within the leadership. I think the position of the negotiators is something that is being relayed by the supreme leader Mujtaba Khamenei, and they are carrying out his orders. And if you look at it, it was a surrender document, so why would they not sign it? That being said, the 10 days statement that is being made from Qatar, my understanding is that Iran isn't or won't sign that as per the current mechanism that by which it is. They are not willing to agree to a deal now, even that brings you back to the MOU, which that 10-day pause wasn't, because they want serious concessions. And so it would only be serious and major concessions in addition to what's already in the MOU, which would bring Iran back to the table. But no, I don't think there's any kind of disagreement between the different groups within Iran. There is normal political disagreement, of course. You do have the far right in Iran. And they are very, like, not happy that the negotiators are negotiating. And then you obviously have the negotiators, and then you have the government and the different branches within Iran. But and obviously there's political, philosophical disagreement. But in terms of them working against each other, that's clearly not happening.
Well, so let's take a look at what headwinds are against the United States being able to get anything that they want here, and how those are being interpreted in terms of policy choices by the Iranian side. So here's one: that the U.S. Stockpiles of our strategic petroleum reserves are at their lowest point since 1983. We are running low on this. This is all open source stuff that they, you know, you can read on the main newspapers here in the West. The U.S. doesn't have enough missiles to return to all that war. The price of gas, I compared here what it was before the war started, what it is today, earlier today. The price of oil was $59 a barrel. Price of gasoline was $2.89. Now it's $84, at least it was this morning. And gasoline in the U.S. is now $4 per gallon, so considerably higher. And now here we have the Ansar Allah. The Houthis have declared that there's a maritime embargo on Saudi Arabia in the Bab al-Mandab. So all those seem to be putting tremendous pressure on the United States and relieving pressure on the Iranian side. And this is from Ghalibaf from yesterday. He says Americans keep bringing new military equipment into the region and claim they're after stopping the war. They bet on our intelligence being as brief as their own IQ. We've reached a stage of mastery in recognizing these American games. And I got to think that all these other things I just put on there. And he said, actions must confirm claims, meaning, I guess, that he's willing to have a negotiated discussion, but only if they get what they want. What do all those things that I just mentioned there in showing the price of gas, the SPRs, the Strait of the Bab al-Mandab, I want to talk about that separately. But first of all that cumulatively, what does that do to the Iranian negotiating team?
Well, the Iranian negotiating team is aware of this. They have, I mentioned it earlier, which is they have a person in Ghalibaf's department specifically tracking the level of oil reserves, tracking how depleted the supplies become on a daily basis, tracking the oil prices in the United States of America. And this is why Ghalibaf was, again, in both instances, wanted to delay the deals. But obviously, Pezeshkian wanted the deal, and so they went somewhere in the middle. So they are well aware of this. They are cognizant of this. And this is very much is part of the equation. In terms of the Americans' supplies, the see it as twofold. One is, you're quite right, they are running out of defense interceptor missiles. They are running out of the ability. They are running out of offensive weapons. That being said, obviously, they're still cognizant that America is a military, and because they don't, like, sometimes, like, when you talk to the average public, they see it as like a Call of Duty game, but they are still cognizant of the fact that this is still the United States of America. They do still have a very strong military. And so they're never, ever going to, you know, take their eye off the ball. So they're ready and aware. So as an example, they're aware that America has limited capability, that they can only strike in the south, as an example. And you've been seeing that where they've only been striking Bandar Abbas, Sirik, Keshem, and Bushehr. And sometimes they'll move a little bit into Shiraz, but not much further. So they're aware. But that being said, I was told that they are cognizant of the fact that there is a possibility that the US may expand the fight attacks to Tehran as well. And so they're aware about America's limited capability, but then they're also cognizant that American military capability is still strong, generally speaking. And so therefore, they do plan based on this escalation that may occur. But yeah, this is a very important factor for sure.
And let's look at the Bab al-Mandab. There was claims. Let's see, where's the one here? It was decided, I guess, yesterday, the Houthi spokesman made that statement. And then today there's been a couple of ships that were forced to turn around. Two Saudi tankers turned around. There's some other traffic that did go through, according to one of the marine trackers that I saw. Some ships are going through, but not Saudi oil cruisers, and they have turned around. The question is, are we going to see a situation in the Bab al-Mandab like we've seen in the Strait of Hormuz in that southern corridor, to where ships are going to try to go through anyway? And then will the Ansar Allah attack them? How do you see that situation?
Yeah, look, I spent a lot of time with Ansar Allah in Iran. And basically, I'm in contact with the different levels of leadership within Ansar Allah. I was aware that they were going to shoot the Bab al-Mandab specifically for Saudi. I'll just explain to you what I know, and then we'll go into the details of what you said. So I'm aware that they have an escalatory ladder in place, and this has been coordinated with Iran. Part of the resistance being in Iran was to coordinate so that neither, you know, so that both sides benefit from the closure of the Bab al-Mandab. Iran gets what it needs, and the resistance in Yemen get what it needs. And what the resistance in Yemen wants is sovereignty. They want the ability to the siege and the blockade to be removed. They want freedom, freedom of movement, freedom of access. That being said, the escalatory ladder is this. There is a closure of Bab al-Mandab to Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia is to escalate, then they will obviously strike Saudi Arabia. If the escalation continues, then they will strike energy infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, the oil infrastructure, the energy infrastructure, for example, Saudi Aramco and various other places. Previously, they said to me, we struck it and we didn't even have the advanced missiles and drones that we have now. Now it's going to be very easy to strike those locations. Then they said that the other option that they've got in the escalatory ladder is to close Bab al-Mandab completely. But right now, closing it for Saudi is very important because Saudi was able to circumvent the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. They were able to move 7 million barrels through the Red Sea. Four to five of those million barrels will be impacted by this. And as you said, there was two. I read earlier that there was actually eight. Three Saudi vessels tried to navigate and then they turned back. So quite clearly, Saudi doesn't want to get into this interaction and engagement. But if they do, they will be struck upon.
And what do you know from the Saudi Arabian side? How are they responding to this and what are their options?
So I don't have inside information from Saudi, but what it seems to me is that when it comes to Saudi Arabia, they don't want to escalate when it comes to Ansarullah. You saw it when the Ansarullah broke the blockade, when 200 Yemenis people went to Iran, were willing to risk their lives. They told me they were willing to die. And this isn't just some average people. The people on that plane were very, very high leadership people, like some people who were essentially heir apparent to the throne, to the leadership, sorry. And there were people in the highest level of the military personnel. But they were all willing to risk their lives to break the blockade and siege when they went to Iran. And at that time, the Saudi fighter just came. The Ansarullah fired at it and they retreated. On the way back, the Saudis made the grave error of striking Sana'a. The Ansarullah had to basically land in Hodeidah and take a long ride back to Sana'a. And you saw the strikes that the Ansarullah did. There was a significant strike both on military base and civilian airbase. And what happened was, not to civilians, but the airbase that was there. And what happened was the Saudis' response was very minimal, where they didn't want to escalate. The Saudis also seemed to be agreeing to a possibility of a Jordanian flight that is going to go to Sana'a. So it seems like the Saudis are ceding to Iran's demands, although there was a statement by the Saudi spokesperson that said that they do not recognize Ansarullah and that they were not going to allow them to take control. So we're going to have to wait and see. In terms of Saudi's actions, they seem to be ceding to Ansarullah. In terms of their statements, obviously they haven't. So it's basically, those are the two elements from Saudi's perspective. But from Ansarullah's perspective, their position is very simple. They are a sovereign nation and they are willing to sacrifice it all. They've been put in a blockade and a siege for 11 years. I'm just looking at the statement. They sent me very long statements about what their position is and what they are saying, and from a few different sources. And they said that, look, Saudi needs to learn that we are a sovereign nation. They can no longer oppress us. We will be breaking the siege. This blockade, and just read this directly. It says, this blockade is not a joke. It was going to be something major. And then from another source from within Ansarullah, he said to me, it's very simple. Saudi needs to accept the fact that this is not a half measure. We will persist with this until they give us our sovereign right. So this is not going to end.
So is that what Ansarullah is? That's what's going to relieve the blockade. It's not an end to the U.S. war against Iran, but it's the Saudi blockade against Ansarullah or Yemen, right?
Yeah, 100%. Ansarullah is an autonomous nation. They're not someone who is just doing the bidding of Iran. And if you look at the specific blockade on Saudi, it is because of the Saudi oppression on Yemen. This has nothing to do with Iran. Now, the other options in terms of closing Bab al-Mandab completely, that will be in, that is actually, not will be, I know it is. It's in coordination with Iran where they'll do it in the right step. But right now, this is specifically on Saudi Arabia. But by doing it on Saudi Arabia, you're affecting the global market, because the reason there was some relief on the futures market in terms of oil prices was because the Saudis were able to get 7 million of barrels of oil through Yanbu and through the pipelines in the Red Sea. And as I mentioned, 5 million of those are going through the Bab al-Mandab, which now the Ansarullah has stopped. And so this is very simple.
This is going to be a big problem for Saudi Arabia. I mean, because they've been able to minimize their income loss by the Bab al-Mandab and by the Yanbu, et cetera. But if that is now closed off, I mean, it's not going to be too many days of no exports through there either. And they're going to be in a world of hurt. I mean, if they literally are losing all of, or at least a good chunk of their national income, I mean, that's going to be a problem, is it not?
Oh, it's going to be a huge problem for Saudi Arabia and the global market, because Saudi Arabia did not get harmed as much as the other Gulf states with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. They were essentially reduced the amount of barrels that were going out by 1-2 million barrels. But because of the high oil prices, essentially they end up almost breaking even, just a slight loss. So they didn't get impacted as much. And this is why they've not been as aggressive about the situation. And they've always been open to having negotiations with Iran, although they've always kind of changed their perspective depending on the scenario and to whom they speak. But now, as you mentioned, with these 5 million barrels, so now you're going to be down to like 1-2 million barrels after what they were selling almost 10 million barrels in the past. You're down to 10% of your output, 20% of your output at best. And even that, there is possible conversations that could be apprehended by Somalia, but we'll have to wait and see on that. But in terms of what's happening now, because that's speculation, what we have is significant impact on the Saudi economy. And there's only going to be a small period of time where they're able to basically persist with this. Obviously, they do have a sovereign wealth fund, but that being said, that is obviously, they'll have to dig into that. But the problem is, overarchingly, this is going to significantly harm the economy, but more so it's going to harm the global market, because now you're taking 5 million barrels a day out of the global market, which was in the market for the last 144 days.
Yeah, that's we'll see how long that goes and how long before Saudi Arabia gives into that. If all they have to do is say we're going to lift the blockade on Ansar Allah, it seems like that's a pretty low bar for Saudi Arabia to go. I mean, I know it would come at some cost, but how do you see that pressure on Riyadh? Are they going to give in to that?
I mean, that's the complexity of it. Logically, as per what you said, for us, it's just like, look, just break the blockade, break the siege, let these people have autonomy. The complexity of it is that Saudi is very much engaged still in Yemen. They have the Saudi-backed Yemenis forces that they claim is the legitimate government within Yemen. If within Yemen, Ansarullah has got about a larger proportion of it, but there is certain areas that still are controlled by the Saudi-backed Yemenis. There was a conflict between the Saudi and the Emirati-backed, but the Saudi-backed forces overcame the Emirati-backed forces. So basically, for Saudi to lift the blockade and the siege would be them conceding that they're removing themselves from Yemen, and it would mean that they're no longer backing the other forces. It would also mean that they're essentially accepting the sovereignty of Ansarullah and the fact that they are the legitimate government of Yemen. So it's a bit more complex in that sense. And so that's why it makes it a lot more complex. It's not as easy as clicking the finger. But that being said, I agree with you in the logical output, the harm that is doing to them. This is Yemen is not their country. Yemen is not their land. And so it's very logical for them to remove themselves from the situation and make sure that their own economy isn't harmed. And also make sure that they had Vision 2030. Saudi was going to be this kind of forefront of the Middle East, almost like a westernized country, highly developed and so on and so forth. And yet with this, you first of all, this war, then the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, and now you have it where essentially you're back into a conflict with Ansarullah, something that they had to beg for a deal in 2023, because after 11 years, they were not able to succeed. Daniel, last year, even the Americans were struggling when it came to, I think it's last year, the year before. Last year.
The 24 Americans, and 25 both.
Yeah, they were struggling as well with Yemen. And they, again, had to retreat, and Trump had to make a deal with them. So Saudi's in a really complex situation in the sense of, it's what you said. It's very easy to make a deal. They should be making a deal, but then they've got to accept that they're going to have to cut off the.
So do you see any other leverage? Because I can see, you're right, it is a complicated deal. To give into that would be a near-term relief, but it would also cause potential longer-term and larger ramifications in the region and their asset access to their version of the Yemenis government, et cetera. Do you see any other leverage Saudi Arabia has to try and get to avoid having to do that, but still get oil out? Do they have any leverage?
They don't have any leverage whatsoever, because what's the options for Saudi? So one is you cede, as per what we've just discussed now, and you accept the sovereignty of Yemen. The other option is you say, no, we're going to get our oil out. How do they get the oil out? Now they're going to have to go kinetic. They try and go kinetic in the Red Sea against Ansarullah, and they're going to struggle because, first of all, Ansarullah will be striking the energy infrastructure. And so the escalatory ladder, I said, and just imagine that. Imagine Saudi Aramco going up in flames. Imagine Saudi's oil depots going up in flames. This will be a major destruction of Saudi infrastructure. And it once again will impact the global financial market and the oil market in an exponential manner. So Saudi is kind of stuck. And it's just been, I personally think it's been a masterful move by Ansarullah, the resistance, because they've kind of played the card at the perfect time to get what they want.
Yeah, we'll see how that's going to go, because so many people are going to be affected by how this one goes. I want to go to, I mentioned earlier here that President Trump made some comments earlier this afternoon that are directly related to this, and I just kind of like your view on some of this. Let's start off here with, first of all, that President Trump is saying, you know, by the way, Iran, they're so degraded, we'll be able to get whatever we want.
Dan, which one would you like?
First one.
They're being degraded so seriously. They did slip something through in Jordan. And if we had other operators, you know, would not happened, unfortunately. But because we have the best equipment in the world, you know, we've stopped almost everything. But when you let other people do your job, with the United States, we let other people do the job, and sometimes it doesn't work out so well.
So his claim there is that, look, I know something slipped through in Jordan, and that's what got the troops killed, but that's because the Jordanians were operating our equipment. But our stuff is, when it's operated by our people, it always works, et cetera. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, it's funny that he's put Jordan under the bus, but then again, the problem he's saying is that if you buy American military equipment, what, only Americans can operate it?
So that's what I don't think he thought that one through.
Yeah. And so the countries need to consider that. But in reality, look, we know that's not the case. We know that there's been significant damage. This has been proven by satellite imagery. As I mentioned earlier in your show, there's very clear. If you look at Muwafiq Salty Air Base, you had the casualties with the soldiers. Three American soldiers died in Jordan. One American soldier died in Iraq. One American soldier died in Syria. You see, for example, in Jordan, the hangars with the fighter jets was taken out. We know that there's been significant damage on apartment complexes, which house U.S. soldiers. You look at the base and it's been very strongly hit and decimated. The radar systems have been taken out. The early warning systems have been taken out. The air defense has been taken out. The logistical hubs have been taken out. And you're just looking at the weakening of these bases and the weakening of these countries in a significant manner. And so this notion that Iran hasn't got the ability, it just makes no sense, because if you look at it, I believe it was yesterday, they were on wave 28 of strikes since this 8 or 10 days of kinetic war. And so they are consistent. Remember, the first 39 days had 100 or 99 strikes, but this time they're already up to 28. They're probably in the 30s now, because this was the count as of yesterday. And so Iran's capability has not been degraded. Iran was, and their belief was, that actually during this entire ceasefire period, I'm being told that they were able to not only get back to pre-war levels, but actually exceed those levels in drones and in missiles. And again, I said that they've not used their best missiles yet. And you've got now, for example, they're using the Chinese Baidu system. You're looking at, for example, they have the Chinese radar systems. And so if you look at the precisions of the strikes, they are so precise that it shows that this Baidu system is highly efficient and highly accurate. And what was happening in the previous 12-day war was that they were Americans were able to use GPS to misdirect some of the missiles. And that issue has now been solved. So Iran... Iran has not been degraded at all. It's the opposite. Iran is in a very strong position, and it's the opposite. They actually believe the Americans have been degraded, and the Telegraph article that you put in the air put up is a prime example of the American missiles and defense systems being degraded. And for example, Ted Postel quite clearly stated, I think he was on your show, he was on my show as well, he said that only 1 to 2% success rate when it comes to the defense interceptors. So they're in a very tough situation. And this is why the evidence is the Israelis. This is why the Israelis are too scared to join the war.
And here's another thing in terms of what the Iranians can't do, allegedly. This is on from Mario earlier today. He said, the aftermath of the Iranian missile strikes on U.S. military facilities in Middle East. And this is from Jordan, I think. U.S. soldiers themselves said that from what I'm hearing, we're getting projected impact data, but the missiles are changing trajectory multiple times in flight. So the projected warnings are no good because they don't know where they're going to end up landing. Targeting data obviously is getting fed to Iran from China and Russia, whether that's directly or from the Baidu system, as you pointed out, who knows. But because they are impacting where they are targeting is insanely precise. So again, that does not sound like somebody who is losing capability that we don't have to worry about. It sounds to me like we have to worry a lot.
No doubt, no doubt. And this is what I just mentioned, which is the level of precision that Iran is able to get is unbelievable. And you've seen, for example, if you look at, for example, the hangar, that's just, it's not like a random strike, right? You're looking at the country of Jordan, and then within there, you're looking at the Muwafiq Salty Air Base, and within there, you're looking at a hangar within there, and then that's been struck. You look at the radar in the same manner it's been struck. You look at some of the logistical hubs, and so the precision of what's happening is unbelievable. Let me give you an example. I was told before the strikes happened that they're going to be targeting in Jordan. They're going to be targeting these complexes which house U.S. soldiers. They said, we're going to be targeting them. And what happened yesterday? We had evidence, visual evidence, I posted it, of them being struck. That shows the level of precision. That was the target point, and that so precisely was what they struck. That demonstrates the level of precision. This isn't just some random attack where they missed their main target and they hit it. That's an example of us being aware of the location of the strike and then that position being struck.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next one here. President Trump says that, I guess, kind of in deference to his previous comment that that Iran doesn't really have the capability. Turns out that it's Iran that is begging Trump.
There are no signs that Iran is ready to stop fighting. So what is the plan? Is the plan to just keep bombing until they give up?
There are no signs. Why do you know something that I don't know?
Well, they continue to attack our allies and
kill
America.
You don't know what the dialogue is behind the scenes, that they want to meet desperately to try and end it because they're getting decimated. You don't get that when you listen to your fake station. But I will tell you, they want to desperately meet. And until they're ready to meet in a meaningful way, we have no interest in even.
So, I mean, there's what's said publicly and what's said privately are two separate things, I suppose. But when the Iranian side hears him just dismiss and mock them and saying, oh, well, they're desperate for a deal. I guess, I think as you, if I understood correctly, you were saying earlier in this show that there is communication. There are links going on. And the Iranian side says we are willing to entertain a possibility. But correct me if I'm wrong, it's only on Iranian terms.
No doubt, no doubt. And they're not talking directly with the United States of America. I just want to be clear on that. They're talking through the Pakistani mediators about this specific issue. And so it's the mediators that are having these conversations, Pakistanis and Qataris, in terms of what the demands are. And there is what I've been told, I can just relay what I've been told, that the Americans have been desperate to go back. They wanted or they planned for this strikes to only happen for a short period of time. And the evidence of this is this. Look, what has happened when the U.S. soldiers were killed? The normal American position would have been what? They would have rained hellfire on any nation where you had the casualties that you had in terms of U.S. soldiers. What was Trump's response? First of all, he tried to brush it off. And the response was the same as the day before, which was the same as the day before, which was the same as the day before, which demonstrates that they don't have the capability to escalate. Now, Iran's position is this. This is what I'm just passing on the information, which is it's the Trump administration that has been begging for the deal, just like they did in the first 39 days. After week two, they came to Iran to ask for a deal. And they're saying that they're coming every single day to beg for a deal. Now, Iran's been very honest. They're saying, look, we're always open, as per what you just mentioned. We're always open to negotiation. Iran's not saying, look, we're going to ignore you. We're going to, you know, you're going to have to deal with it. No, they're always willing to talk because they want peace. But they're saying you need to talk, as what you just said, I think you put it so brilliantly, you need to talk on our terms, which is that the MOU you violated. Now you need to, there needs to be new elements added to the MOU. You need to add more concessions to the deal. And then only then will we agree to a conversation. So they're not
and
even
asking. What new concessions would they require?
That one, I'm not sure. I didn't ask that question. I should have asked that. That's a good question. I will try and get that information, but I actually didn't. I'm not sure about the specifics of what those concessions are going to be. If I had to guess, I assume it would maybe be like, for example, the frozen assets being released earlier. It could possibly be, for example, American bases being removed from the vicinity of Iran. So it means like Kuwait, Bahrain, and UAE and these type of areas, Saudi Arabia. Those would be possibilities in terms of comments, but this is just speculation from my side. I have no inside information pertaining to what the specifics of that are. But what I do know is there needs to be serious concessions. And apparently, according to what I've been told, that the document in Qatar, the first version, I don't know about any updates since then, but the very first version was just ridiculous. Apparently, it was something along the lines of the MOU would be reactivated, but there would be two corridors. There would be the American corridor and the Iranian corridor. And obviously, there'll be never a scenario where Iran accepts that.
Yeah. It's just so many things that just don't make any sense. Last thing I want to run past you here from what President Trump said is he said that he was asked how long is the fight going to go on? And he said, basically, it'll go on until I decide it's going to stop and until we force an opening of the Strait of Hormuz.
If the Iranians do not make a deal, ultimately, how long will it take for you to stamp out their threats to the Strait and enable full shipping?
So if we left right now, it would take Iran 20, 25 years to rebuild. Okay? And we're not finished at all. But if we left right now, it would take them a long time, years to rebuild. You saw the number of protesters that they killed, 52,000 plus. I put a couple of them up today, young kids that kill them. They kill them like they're candy. It's crazy. But if I didn't do the attack on their nuclear sites, or if I didn't terminate the Obama agreement with Iran, which was a road to a nuclear weapon, and our deal will be a wall. It already is. They can't have a nuclear weapon right now. It would take them years to produce it. And we will absolutely attack the new site that they're talking about. I mean, how about these people? They're in this because of nuclear weapons, and they're trying to possibly reconstitute a site. We'll hit that site. Any site where they're even thinking about nuclear, we'll be hitting it very, very powerfully.
So he's talking, we'll start with the last part first. Several things I want to ask from there. That's a pickaxe mountain that he was referring to there. And he's claiming like, oh yeah, we're definitely going to hit that. What does Iran think about Pickaxe Mountain, and what will they do if he hits it?
Well, they just think it's ridiculous because Pickaxe Mountain is it's not too far. It's south of Tehran, and it's not too far away from the other nuclear facility that was already struck. Now, there is a possibility, obviously, Trump may try and strike it, but I mean, from Iran's perspective, they aren't expecting that to happen, because if you look at the level of strike that you're going to need, the level of impact, from my understanding, you would need something a lot stronger than just a B-2 bomber because of the fact that the mountain is made of granite. And apparently, if you strike it, what it does is it hardens the place. So the issue you've got is it's not just as easy to strike it. But that being said, what he's saying is just completely ridiculous. First of all, he's just made a number of lies, which is there wasn't 52,000 protesters that were killed. That's just completely ridiculous. In addition to that, he's saying he set Iran back, 20, 25 years. What has he done in this new part of the war that allegedly has set Iran back. It makes no sense whatsoever. Iran still has the same capability as had before. It has the same amount of missiles and drones. They're able to rebuild. According to Israel, Israel claim, and this is the claim about pickaxe, Israel is the ones who claim that Iran has rebuilt their nuclear facility and their different nuclear elements that is needed to build a nuclear bomb. So if it's so easy for Iran to do so, then that just demonstrates that he has not blocked the capability of Iran to rebuild their nuclear capability. And Iran's position has always been very simple. And something I disagree with, I do think that they should have the nuclear bomb. It's a deterrence from a deterrence perspective. But their position has been that, look, they don't want the nuclear bomb. They do believe that they should be allowed to enrich uranium from a domestic perspective. They are a big Bitcoin miner that requires nuclear energy to do it in the optimum manner. Nuclear energy is required for civilian use. Trump was open to that. So his entire stance now is just the antithesis of what his stance was when he was signing the MOU. And I am a big believer that the Israeli lobby did pressure him into basically going back on the MOU deal, first by violating Article 1. And you saw Joseph Aoun there, who was part of the traitorous new agreement, which was between them, Israel, and the United States of America, which circumvents Article 1 of the MOU deal. And so what you've got is, I believe that Trump has been pressured by Marco Rubio and those who are pro-Israel within the United States of America to backtrack on the MOU deal, to backtrack and basically go back into the kinetic part of the war. And the worst thing is they're not going in themselves because they know the danger that Israel is going to face. Now, they may jump in after a bit if they're desperate, if they believe that the Americans are going to pull out. But at the moment, they're not willing to do it themselves. And so they're willing to sacrifice American lives. They're willing to sacrifice Iranian lives while they sit out.
Yeah, that's I find that very egregious and insulting. One other thing he mentioned there, I'd like your view on if it came up at any point. What is the Iranian reaction when they keep hearing over and over, because Trump said this 100 times, that the JCPOA, the so-called Obama nuclear deal, was a road to a bomb for Iran? And only because he got out did he save the world from Iran already having a nuclear weapon. How do they react to that?
Yeah, I did have the conversation about that, actually, because now you mentioned it, like it comes up. But I did actually have that conversation. And he said, look, we followed the JCPOA, even though the JCPOA that we agreed, we did not believe it was very beneficial for Iran in the sense of it was a lot of concessions were made in the JCPOA. But they said that we followed it and we continued to follow it. And they said, even when Trump tore up the deal, we talked and we had conversations and we said, look, we're still going to follow it. So for one whole year after Trump tore up the JCPOA, they continued to follow it. So the way they see Trump is two things. One is obviously when he says things, they just ignore it. They just see him as someone who lies and doesn't tell the truth about anything. But the second element is that he just is untrustworthy when it comes to deals. But that being said, as I mentioned earlier, that even though they see that, he is the president of the United States of America. And so when you negotiate through Pakistan and Qatar, you're going to have to negotiate with the Americans because the other choice is persistent war. So the way they see it is they don't trust them. They don't believe the JCPOA was a road to the nuclear bomb. It's the opposite. They believe it was major concessions given by Iran, and they followed it even a year after. But now they believe that they have all the cards. And so, therefore, it's the Americans that need to concede.
Well, we're going to find out how that's going to work out here in the next bit. We'll be real interested in whatever you say is now maybe 2 or 3 days away from something big coming from Iran. I guess we'll be watching for that, too, and see what happens in Washington. Who knows where this is going to go? But we really appreciate you coming on today and sharing this insider information that you have across the region. We really appreciate it. And can send people to Suleiman Ahmed's YouTube site here, where he has lots of great shows where he talks more and more about this and has other interviews there.
Yeah, my YouTube channel is Moral Resistance. It's not that one, but yeah, you can check me out. Yeah, so you can check me out on the Moral Resistance channel, where I've had the honor and privilege of interviewing you, Daniel, on a number of occasions. So I really would, do check that out. But thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Always look forward to having you back, and we'll probably have you back on again soon after whatever happens next does come. We appreciate you guys. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.